All right, welcome to another edition of the Edlo Podcast. Subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. This is a little different. I've done pro wrestling, I've done baseball, I've done missionaries, theologians, I've done politicians. Now I have our American gladiator. I have Jim Starr, aka Laser, the longest running American gladiator from the original show. And so, what should I call you, Jim or Laser?
Well, just call me Jim for short.
All right. Well, Jim, thanks for coming on. So you were really the longest running American gladiator.
I was. We had, was it seven? I forget. It's been so long. 7.5 seasons. Every season was considered around 26 episodes. The first season aired in 1989. And I missed the first 13 episodes, and that's when they had Malibu. And Malibu just didn't quite cut it. He just wasn't a good athlete. I'm not putting him down, but he just didn't have the physicality as being a tough guy, right? So, you know, so they stopped production, and lo and behold, they held another tryout, and I tried out and made the show for the second half of the first season. So, yeah, I was on it for a good 7-8 years. Long time. Man.
So how did you get on American Gladiators? Were you invited? Were you did you just go to an audition? How did that work?
Yeah, it's funny you ask. So my roommate was Dan Clark, who was Nitro. Dan and I played ball with the Rams during the strike season, and him and I just hit it off, became best friends. And I had a serious injury with the Rams and got a pretty good payment out of the injury. And so Dan and I lived off my income for about 3 years. So we were partiers, and we worked out every day, and we started like, what are we going to do with our lives? Right. So I had a degree, but you know, the last thing I wanted to do is go work full time when my passion was to still play professional football. Unfortunately, with that injury, nobody else would sign me. So Dan and I started doing commercial work in LA. We were down in Orange County at the time and doing the commute. We were doing extra work, and we just thought that was just fun, right? Just making a few bucks. And one thing led to another. And I started doing fairly well with national commercials. And Dan and I had the same agent. And Dan will tell a different story, but this is how I recall it. And him and I argue about it. But Dan got a call from our agent. And our agent said, hey, there's this new show called American Gladiators. Do you want to try out? It's physical. It's right up your alleyway. And let Jim know. And Dan never told me that he went out for this, for this tryout. Well, lo and behold, Dan got casted for the Gladiators, right? And I can't believe he can't recall it, because I had an argument with him at the house. We were renting an apartment together. And I was upset that he never told me. Well, lo and behold, he said, that's not how it happened. But that I can tell you, that's how it happened. So when they stopped production, Dan said to the producers and directors, hey, I got the perfect guy. He's my roommate, played in the NFL, and he boxed. He was a wrestler. And so they held the tryouts, even though they had to hold them. Boy, there was a ton of us that tried out, and it was a 3-day tryout. And at that time, here's what's interesting, is my playing weight was about 228, 235 pounds. And my agent kept saying, Jim, you got to lose some weight. You got too much muscle. Let's get you down about 205, 210. And you can probably do a little bit modeling. I don't think I'm a model, but so I went back to Montana for 3 months over the summer. And I was doing cardio about 5 hours a day, literally. And I was still at 230. I was about 5% body fat. So all I did was lose muscle mass, and I got down to 210. And when the Gladiators had that tryout, I was 208, and I was going against guys that were 240, 270. But the reality was I was kicking their ass on Conquer. I was doing all these events, and these producers were like, shit, this guy is only 210 pounds. And then all of a sudden, you know, then I got casted for the Gladiator. So that's how it worked out.
Was there one of the challenges that you found was like your challenge, the one that you were always, I always remember there seemed to be like, each guy had one challenge that they were specialized in. Did you, yeah. What was yours?
Yeah. I mean, I was pretty damn good at the joust and the conquer ring, which was the wrestling ring in Powerball. But I really enjoyed the joust stick competition just because it was that one-on-one. And I was a boxer and I had enough fist fights in my life, but I just loved that. I don't know. There was something about that being up on that pedestal about 10 feet high and being victorious. I didn't lose. I think I had myself and Turbo probably had the best record over the course of 7 years. And I just loved it. And then obviously the conquer ring where, you know, you're just an animal and the guy's trying to take you out of that little circle. And it just, I loved it. Yeah.
Did you ever do, I can't remember what it was called, but it was the one where you were standing up, you had the gun and you were shooting tennis balls at the guy as he was running out.
Assault rifle or whatever. Yeah. I didn't enjoy that, even though it was fun. It was like you're just up there and shooting tennis balls at 110 miles an hour. But I kind of liked it because, you know, I grew up in Montana. I was a hunter and still am outdoor. I do big game hunting. So it was just kind of fun to get up there and plink those contenders off. So that was kind of fun though.
Yeah. So talking about you, tell us, you know, obviously you're an athlete. Where are you? Let's talk about your family in Montana. Where are you in the birth order?
Yeah. So I got an older sister, 1 year older. I'm 62 now, but I have a younger sister that's 5 years younger and a younger brother who is a stud athlete. He played football at University of Montana for the Grizzlies, and I played at Montana State with the Bobcats. But my family history, my grandpa was a hell of an athlete. He was a national handball champion. He had the biggest set of hands I have ever seen. Mine are fairly big, but people still talk about my grandpa today. He had sausages. I mean, just his fingers were just gnarly. And when I got to tell you the story. So when we were little, my siblings and I would always ask my grandpa to put his hand in the fire. He had calluses. He was a carpenter. And he could actually put his hand in the fire because his calluses were so thick. And we would just get a kick out of it. But he was tough. I mean, just a tough guy. And then my dad, he was a boxer and a football player. He actually went to Washington State, and he had a scholarship for football, and he also boxed. He was on the national championship boxing team with Washington. And unfortunately, my dad, and no, you can look it up, but he actually got kicked out of college for beating up a guy so bad in a bar. You know, and back in those days, you know, fights were everywhere, right?
Right.
Nobody got kicked off the football team, but yeah, it was pretty bad. And that's when my mom met my dad. My mom was from North Hollywood, and she went to Washington State, and they met, and they moved back to Montana, and that was it. But yeah, we got a kind of a pedigree of some pretty good athletes, and my brother, like I said, was quite the athlete himself.
Well, what I find so interesting, and I'm sure there's a genetic component to this, but what I find interesting is that successful athletes breed other successful athletes. And there's got to be something about that upbringing that creates that other than just all being genetically gifted. What do you think it is?
Yeah, you're spot on. I mean, you're dead on right there. I think just for me personally, And I've talked about this. You're the first person ever on a podcast or someone that's asked me that specific question, but I've alluded to it in a roundabout way. And the only thing I can come back to is when I was young, my dad wasn't, you know, our dads back then weren't really loving individuals. They weren't our buddies, right? They were a parent. And my dad never paid a lot of attention to me as a young kid. And he didn't encourage me to play football or basketball or wrestling or track. I just went out and did those sports. But where I found myself wanting to be better was because I wasn't getting his attention. And so what I would do is do everything I could I'd go into the weight room and get bigger and look at me, Dad, and never get that acknowledgement that my dad, that I wanted from my dad. And I did it in high school. I did it in college. And I think I just kept wanting his attention so badly that it drove me to be better and better and better. And I even though my dad has now passed in 2009, I find myself, even in my work environment on the corporate side, still working my ass off because I want that recognition. And it's not about being a narcissist or having a big ego. It's just about finding that common ground with people that you love. And you just want their attention. You just want them to recognize you. And I don't think I ever got it. I never did. And I did it for my dad. Even though my mom was the sole hero of our family, she was the one that was at the games. And she'd be the one I'd be looking for in the stands to see if she showed up. So I don't know. That's a really interesting question, because it doesn't come down to just having a pedigree of great athletes like the Manning brothers and the old man and stuff. But yeah, I think it really comes down to that.
One thing that I found really interesting about successful people, I've been very successful in a lot of the things that I do. I'm an attorney now, and it's been a great career, is that there is a level of constant improvement that you need, and an extra work that you put in when you are looking for some sort of recognition that you don't have. You know what I mean? Like there's something about almost like I hear recently there's this new push of you are enough, right? Like that's kind of the thing. And I go, but what does that mean? Right? Like where's the, you're enough. Like, I'm constantly trying to be better. So if I felt like I was enough, would I really achieve the level of success that I have if I felt like what I was doing was good enough?
Right.
But at the same time, you got to strike a balance where is it ever going to be enough? So let me ask you, you're a little bit older now. You've done all these great things. You've had some success in the corporate world. Are you still trying to achieve and find things?
Yeah, I am. I every day of my life, let me back up. So everyone, my wife says, God, you've traveled the world, and God, you did the gladiators, you played professional football, you went over to Italy, you've done all these amazing things. You've had super, super great paying jobs, but you're still never satisfied. And I'm not. Yeah. And I just, I don't find myself ever bragging that I'm a gladiator. I just happen to have a job on TV. That's how I look at it. So I just don't, I'm just never satisfied. I just, there's not a drive in me. Like there is a drive to be better, but I'm just not, I've never been okay with what I've done. I don't look at it that way. And I don't, maybe that's what's driving me. I'm just not satisfied. I don't know what it is. I'm not quite happy with where I am still today.
You know, it's funny you bring that up. You're bringing up a lot of stuff for me too, because I'm a partner at my law firm, and that was the goal. I became an attorney. I've been an attorney now 12 years, but I remember when I started as an attorney, my mentor, who is the managing partner of my firm, he's been great for my career. You know, he knew exactly what to do. He's probably one of the better coaches I've ever had in my life. And he looked at me as soon as I came back from the bar, and he goes, "I don't think you're going to make it. I don't even know why I hired you." You know what I mean? Like you should quit now. I don't even know why you're here, but I'll give you your shot. Yeah. Wow. But you know, the thing was that I remember walking away from that. I think he knew just who I was. You know, I'd worked for him for 3 years at that point. And so I looked at there and I just go, all right, well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to work as hard as I can for you. And one of these days when you finally give me my due, I'm going to shove it back in your face. Right. And so 10 years later, I'm sitting in his office. And he tells me that the partnership had voted unanimously to make me the newest partner of the firm. And I did just that. I said, I wanted to remind you the first thing you said to me when I came back from the bar, you know, so now's the day that I get to shove it back in your face. And he was so happy about it. He was like, that's great. You know what I mean? And so I walked, but then I went back to my office and I sat there, and that had been the goal for so long. And I sat there and I remember sitting there for a few minutes and going, okay, is that enough? Are you satisfied? Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, what's next? Yeah, you know what I mean?
Right.
But I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't think it is. I mean, an interesting concept or like how we parallel you and I, my kids, I have two daughters from a previous marriage and then a son that I adopted from my wife today when he was 18, I ended up adopting him. And in his eyes, he looks at like, I like the attention, right? Mm-hmm. You know, because I've always had it, right? I've been in tons of magazines and newspaper clippings and oh my God, it was just overwhelming. I don't know if I'd like the attention as I do what I did to get the attention.
Yeah.
So on the field, oh my God. Now, aftermath, if you want to write up a story about Jim Starr, Jim Calafat, great. But it was it's the work that I did on the field and in the weight room that paid off of why I liked the attention.
Yeah.
That was more to it. And I've always tried to articulate it because my son has said that to me a few times. Oh, you just like the attention. You've always had this attention. No, I really haven't. I get embarrassed when some, you look familiar. You're a gladiator. Yeah. I get kind of embarrassed. Right. It's, I can't articulate. I kind of understand what you're saying. And I just don't understand I don't get how to articulate what I'm trying to convey.
Yeah, I think I've talked about, it's funny you bring this up because I was I was on a panel just a couple of weeks ago for first year law students about what it takes to be a good lawyer. And then I just did a career fair for my kids' school and I was talking to high school students about it. And the high school students in particular, they know me and I have I drive a Ford Raptor and then I got a 2020 Shelby Cobra in my garage and I sometimes drive that, drive my son to school.
Now I'm doing it. I love it. Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but they love that. Right. They said, and my kids always tell me, they're like, oh, you love bragging about your cars. Right. And I go, no, I don't like bragging about my cars. Yeah. What I love is that those cars are a symbol. Up until 2019, I was driving a 2012 Camry. Right. And I had just made enough of the right moves at the right times and worked really, really hard for about, a decade, 9 years getting through school and then another decade working my tail off to obtain those things. And so it's really not, when you're saying you don't love the attention, you love what it got, it sounds to me like the attention comes because of all of the work you put in to be noticed. Right. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah,
for sure. And that's one thing that a lot of people don't see. They see the end result, right?
Right.
The accolades or someone's picture in the paper or on TV or someone driving, a beautiful vehicle, but they don't realize all the hard work that got you there. Right.
Right.
The hours in the gym and the dedication and the dieting and the hard work at the bar exam and the endless hours of studying and giving up the nights of partying with your buddies because you knew the long end goal was to pass the bar so you could take care of yourself and hopefully a family. So that's the thing that it kind of upsets me that people, a lot of people in this world are jealous of other people. They really are. I got a good buddy in Montana that's very well off, grew up in Montana, still lives there, became went to Boeing, was an engineer, and decided to give that up and married a gal from Montana and became a farmer. And one thing led to another. Now he's the most successful businessman in Montana, owns tons of bars and restaurants. And there are so many people that are jealous of him, but they don't see the hard work that it took for him to get there. It's like, come on, people, just give it a break.
Right. Well, and it's interesting too, especially, it's, I'm going to start sounding like back in my day kind of thing, but the younger people, the younger generation coming up, I'm not seeing the same level of grit that someone like you, I'm sure, had to get to the level that you got to. because I mean, you're not seeing people who are willing to stay after five, mm-hmm. or the people who are willing to put in that extra work. You know, I've been telling my son, he just got through playing varsity basketball, and he's a singer and a musician and doing all these things. And he's finally, his senior year, kind of got it. And he's just a monster doing everything. I mean, yeah. He's all over the place. And he finally got, oh, wait, if I just work hard, I can achieve.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so now let me ask you, as you were going through all this stuff, as you were pursuing football in particular, because I mean, I think you would agree, as far as your numbers, I mean, as far as your height and weight, your stats, you're kind of a smaller guy for football.
Yeah, well, especially back in those days, you know, when
right.
you're especially you're talking inside linebackers, they were all 6'1 to 6'4. That was the yeah. stereotypical linebacker. And that really hurt me because yeah. I, at the end of the day, I had the best stats in terms of the 40, the 220, the benching 225, the shuttle, that you name it. And I was passing up guys that were drafted, and it hurt. It really hurt me at being 5'11 and 228. And now if I was 6'1, 6'2, shit, I probably would have been, you know, top draft choice. But that's just how it was. Nowadays, shit, there's linebackers in the NFL that are all 5'9, 5'10, 5'11, and it does not matter. Right. It's really right. unfortunate. I think that it really hurt me. It really did.
But let me ask you, through all these things that you've done, I mean, you know, you played – professional football, you mentioned Italy, you were you know, you still hold records in your high school, and you played in college.
Yeah.
Did it ever once occur to you that you couldn't achieve those things?
The It never occurred to me that I could achieve those. You see what I mean? I never even thought I could achieve those things. They just happened. I didn't even know, to be honest. All I know is I wanted to play football in high school. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know what it was like to go on a recruiting trip and to get a full ride scholarship. I mean, I was so naive to the fact that these things were happening. All I knew is I just wanted to train, be the best of the best. I knew I wanted to play in the NFL. I didn't know how to get there. And fortunately, mm-hmm. I had some really, really good, loving, successful, just tough freaking coaches that I certainly looked up to the next level. I mean, it was, I think I worked my ass off to impress my coaches more than I wanted to impress myself. That's for sure.
Right. Wow. So now, you mentioned your dad and some of the issues you had, hoping to get some approval from him. Do you think that was similar for your other siblings? Have you guys ever talked about that?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. No one really got the attention that they wanted, especially my brother, too. I mean, he was, before my dad passed, I went to this men's weekend retreat, and it was about men being men and how men are walking around society all hurt, and they don't know how to function because of the lack of love that they receive from their fathers. And it was about embracing what you do have, not what you don't have. Mm-hmm. So I went through this men's weekend retreat. It wasn't spiritual or all of that. It was about men being men and to forgive your fathers, for they didn't know the difference of what they were doing. So I went on this men's weekend retreat, and I forgave my father and just put my arm around him, told him I loved him. And I said to my brother, this was 2000, my dad passed in 2009. It had to have been 2007, somewhere in there. And I asked my brother, I said, Joe, dad's not going to be around forever. I said, you just need to let go of your anger and whatever you're feeling, and just tell him that, hey, he did a hell of a job. He couldn't do it. And I'm telling you, he's kicking himself in the ass today because he didn't have it in here yet. And here, to forgive our dad for not giving him the attention and loving him the way we as children want to be loved unconditionally. Right. So,
sure.
You know, and he's living with that pain today. It's really unfortunate.
Yeah. You know, that's a good point. Now I wanted to ask you, cause this is something, quite frankly, that I struggle with, forgiveness. right?
Yeah.
What did that do for you?
Oh man. You're gonna make me cry, don't you? I'm an emotional dude, so I'll probably start tearing up. But what it did for me, holy shit, I gotta tell you, it changed the trajectory of the freaking anger that I had inside me just fucking built up all those years. I mean, I love my dad, but I hated him at the same time. Just hated, like, God, but I never lipped off to him. I never said anything. I was scared to death of my dad. Mm-hmm. He never abused us, never kicked, never hit us, but I was scared of him. And man, I just, yeah, I don't even know what to say. I mean, I don't know. I lost my train of thought. I'm so emotionally distraught over all of that. Sorry.
It's okay. You know, it's interesting you bring that up because it's funny as you get older, the perspective that you have, especially when you have your own kids.
Yeah.
Because like my dad, I've been very open on the podcast here. My dad is somewhere between 25 and 30 years sober. He, all throughout up until I turned about 17, 18 years old, he had a drug problem. And now he is one of the best men you'd ever meet. Wow. I mean, he's amazing. Now I have a sister, who is about 21 years younger than me. And I have four siblings, three of us kind of all same generation. And then her, and we all joke that she got the dad we all kind of wanted.
Yeah.
But she's a little entitled. So, you know, she doesn't have any grit either, but the thing that was so funny is, I've gotten older and I have my kids and my son is about the age I was when he was going through his stuff. I realized the pressure that he was under, and he didn't have a dad growing up, you know, he didn't really have an example. And I realized, I was like, man, despite all the demons and all this stuff, he really did the best he could. And it allowed me over the years, as time passed, it allowed me to let go of some of that resentment I had.
Yeah.
And as you got older. So perhaps knowing what you were dealing with your father and what it did for you, both good and bad. I mean, you're incredibly successful for some of that. How does that inform the way you've raised your kids?
Here's, man, you've asked some really good questions. I overcompensated because I didn't get the love and the attention from my dad, right? So I overdid it in that arena. But where I lacked, and I kicked myself in the butt today as a father, which is what my dad did, is he took me out hunting, showed me how to hunt, fish. And I didn't know I was spending valuable time with my dad because all I focused on is he wasn't paying attention to me with hugging me and kissing me or whatever. Mm-hmm. Where I fell short is I didn't take my kids one-on-one and take them to the park or show my son how to change an oil filter or the oil in your vehicle or just take him to the park and play baseball with him or football. Mm-hmm. And guess what? That's what my kids think about today. They don't talk about I didn't love them enough and apologize when I got upset. It was I didn't spend any time with them. So you no matter what, we as parents, we try to do the best we can, but we don't have that magic ball in front of us, you know, the crystal ball that says, hey Josh, hey Jim, you're doing this right. But guess what? You better do a little bit more of this. And I wish we did, because nobody teaches us how to be parents. We learn from our parents and we learn from their mistakes and we try to be better. And I just dropped the ball there, man, on that one. And I, gosh, and I see my son-in-law, who I have two grandkids that are 4 and 1. I've never seen a dad that is so attentive to his kids. When he comes home from a long day's work, he puts his phone down and it's all about the kids. Yeah. Man, I wish I would have done that. I was just, I did my own thing, you know.
Yeah.
Thank you, honey. My dogs were whining. It's just gosh darn, I wish we had all the answers to being a parent, but we don't. And all we can do is talk about it to our kids and hopefully they'll pass it on to their own kids.
It's funny because you don't know what you don't know when you're going through
it. You don't know what you don't know. Isn't that the truth?
Yeah. And I remember telling my son, I think it was his freshman year, we got in a brouhaha, you know, he was really angry and I was really angry and we blew up at each other.
Oh yeah.
And I calmed down after a little while, you know, and I finally came back to him and I sat down with him and all I said to him was, and this is my oldest kid, right? So he's the guinea pig.
Yeah.
I told him, I go, hey, listen, man, I go, I've never parented a teenager before and you've never been a teenager before. So how about I agree to give you a little slack and you give me a little slack and we'll just call it even.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, there were bumps along the way, but I thought a conversation like that was really helpful.
Sure.
And, you know, because, yeah, I mean, we're just all, you could even read all the books out there and still not know what you're doing in the moment. You know what I mean? With these kids.
Yeah.
So tell me, when American Gladiators, I mean, you're there for 7 seasons.
Yeah.
You were, and I understand you were kind of named the team captain of all the Gladiators.
Yeah, every year I was voted team captain, which was pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So as you're going through that, was there, I mean, as new people came on, were you kind of someone in a mentor capacity that kind of helped them see their way through the TV stuff?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, we had quite a few different Gladiators, male and females that came onto the show, maybe lasted a year, maybe 2 years. Mm-hmm. And you tried to be that voice and that role model for these new athletes coming in. But again, it was competition, right? Even though you're a team, we all wanted to be the best of the best.
Right.
And so even though, you know, there was some team type events that we were involved in, like Powerball, where there was 3 Gladiators, 2 contenders,
right.
You know, we would really strategize and come together and the gauntlet where we all had different devices and the contenders were running down. But yeah, we just tried to, it was still competition where we tried to mentor who we could, but then again, you didn't want to give up everything you knew because you still wanted to beat out the Gladiators that you were side by side with. Right.
So, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
It was kind of tough. Yeah.
Yeah. So were there ever any sort of quarrels or fights in between Gladiators?
Yeah, there was.
Yeah.
It probably stemmed from me too, because at the time, and I'm still trying to deal with the demons, you know, I have a temper and it's Dan and I got in a few difficulties along the way. We had a live tour show and we had some disagreements and really in the overall picture, in the scheme of things, I mean, as long as we were all together, especially we were on that tour bus for 6 months on this live tour, we all got along on that one. I mean, we were like little kids in a candy shop on that tour, but yeah, there was probably some battling going on. I know that there was a time where one of the trainers didn't tape my ankle up correctly and I needed it taped differently and he wouldn't do it on my time frame. And it used to be on YouTube. I don't know if they took it down, but I called him every name in the book. I mean, I went after him and literally went after the trainer and I don't know who, I think Thunder stepped in and stopped me and it was all on YouTube. I don't know if they took it down, but yeah, I mean, in the most part, everything was good. Yeah.
Yeah, man. Did you ever, so when, you know, these competitions, I'm just curious, did you guys ever test each other out on these competitions?
No, we never did. If you were to ask me who the best all around Gladiator athlete there was, I'd have to say, you know, people ask me that and it's probably Galen Tomlinson, who was Turbo. Mm. He was on the show for maybe 3 seasons. He had the long dark and then he cut his hair, but he had the long dark hair and he never played sports outside of high school, but you talk about a stud. Oh my God, that guy was such an athlete and so intense, strong, quick, fast, just phenomenal at every event. I mean, all around athlete. You know, a lot of these guys like Tower, he's still my buddy today, 6'4". There are certain things that he can do and can't do because of his height and all. He wasn't very good at the wall and some other things. But yeah, Turbo, man, he was – that guy was a stud. He was a beast.
Yeah. So when you're going through this for those seven seasons, I interview a lot of professional wrestlers and they talk about just kind of the lifestyle around being a pro wrestler. I got to imagine it's different because you guys weren't touring that much. It was probably more just the television aspect of it.
Yeah.
But I mean, you're back in the late 80s, early 90s. Was it kind of a party lifestyle you guys were around at the time?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I mean, I take that, we filmed about 3 weeks out of the year. So we did all 26, 28 episodes in about a 3 week time span. And then after that, most of us didn't see each other unless we did autograph sessions and signings throughout the year. But the competition was intense, but it was a time on the tour that got a little out of hand in terms of all of us, where most of us got to, there was a couple athletes that we just did not like. Like most of them, here's what happened is on the Gladiator show, they would have the contenders and the gladiators in separate dressing rooms. And they never wanted us to fraternize with the contenders because I didn't want to know who they were. I didn't care about their names, what they look like, because if I become your friend, even if I talk to you for 10 minutes, I'm probably going to like you. Right. And there's something about inside of you as an athlete that you may not just give it your all, right?
Right.
Take your head off. And so they did keep us separated except for lunchtime. And I wasn't the friendliest guy in terms of wanting to be their friend. Like Nitro, he wanted to go talk to everybody. I mean, that's just Dan.
Yeah.
So yeah, that competition where you don't want to be too friendly to everybody. That was really, I took that on pretty seriously. Yeah.
Yeah. So now after American Gladiators ends, well, let me ask you this, back, I think early 2000s, they redid American Gladiators. Hulk Hogan was involved in it, stuff like that. What did you think of the reboot?
What a freaking joke.
Yeah.
And I wasn't, this is being, being honest, is that if I were to watch that from the end user's point of view versus me as a gladiator, I thought it was awful. I mean, if I were to compare the two shows, the original plus the revision, if you want to call it, it was just hokey. I mean, yelling, and they had Wolf screaming like a wolf, and it just became too Hollywoodish. And the unfortunate thing is all of us gladiators tried to be on the reboot of the NBC Gladiator show, and they didn't even want to talk to us. They didn't even want us to have cameo appearances or be a host for a show or be a trainer to the new gladiators. These new producers and directors all obviously thought that they could do it on their own, and they found out it didn't work very well because all the fan base was like, where's the original gladiators? Have us on there for a personal appearance, maybe. They just didn't see it. And unfortunately, that show only lasted, I think, a season two, I think.
Yeah.
I don't even know.
I don't know. I watched like two episodes and it just wasn't for me. I just didn't like it.
It wasn't authentic. It was just a joke, but it is, and then they had Michael O'Hearn on there. He was Titan, but he was on our show as an alternate. So he didn't make our show for obvious reasons, but he made the revision of it. So
interesting. So now after American Gladiators ends, tell me, what do you do next?
I was in fear of what am I going to do next? Like I was, when I got injured, when I got cut up at the CFL, I got drafted by the USFL and we did a dinner theater show down in Kissimmee, Florida for 2.5 years. And a lot of us had to leave our families and go months and months to go down there. And then we come back home to our families. And I was on the Dinner Theater Show, and I became really good friends with a guy named Reggie Beegler, who was Tank. Tank and I are still good friends today. Him and I went out one night partying, and we went out partying, and we were in a parking structure, and he was on the first floor, and I could hear him yelling, "Jim!" I got out of my car, and I was on the second level of the parking structure. He goes, "I'm down here." So goofy me, I'm in cowboy boots, and I don't want to walk down all the way around the stair to get to the stairs. I decided to jump over the second story to the first story, and I hit my heel on the cowboy boot onto the parking structure, like where you park, and it hit that, and oh my God, my ankle. It was the worst, one of the worst injuries. And that was the end of my career. I mean, I went home, and it was the first time in my entire, I was 30, 36, 35, something like that. And I said to myself, because I got injured on that show more than any other gladiator as well. I had, oh my God, in the seven seasons, I had 13 operations. Ooh. And I questioned myself, do I really want to do this? Like, I really I understood why athletes retire and they're in their prime. And we as watchers of that organization or that person's career, you're like, how could they retire?
Yeah,
man, I just had enough. I was done. I never, that was the end of my career. And when I made that decision, fear set in. Like, what am I going to do now? I was a personal trainer. I did that on the side to make some money. And then I finally got serious and said, well, I'm going to convert my whole garage into a fitness studio and try to become the most successful trainer I could be, which I was doing really well for about 2 years post Gladiators. And then I got in the corporate world and been doing the same type of business for the last 27 years. So,
wow. And now how do you like that?
I love it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm with a new company now, NSF. They're a third party audit certification testing company. They've been around since 1944. You've probably seen the NSF logo on plumbing supplies, personal care products, dietary supplements for certified for sport. I've worked with that company on and off since 2009. And my really good friend, who now is my boss, who works for NSF, suggested I apply for the director of client engagement, and I went through five intense interviews and in November and received the welcoming packet that I got the job. And boy, I was so blessed and happy. And it's been the best career and best job I've ever had. It's been fantastic.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So now another thing that's interesting, I didn't realize this, but you were actually in the movie Roadhouse.
Yeah, I just watched the remake with Jake and Conor McGregor last night. It's goofy as hell. It's kind of goofy, but man, did you watch it?
I haven't seen it yet. That's why I wanted to bring it up. I want to be like, so what did you think? I mean, you're an original.
It was just such a quick, it was when I was doing extra work, Dan and I, actually Dan Clark Nitro, I think he got casted for, we were all bouncers. And but I'm in the movie two or three different little sections in time, you know, no big deal role, but at least I got, you know, on there with Patrick Swayze. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah. It is. Yeah. So, well, listen, you've had awfully a very good, you've been very successful in your life in a lot of areas. So if you were talking to a young person, some of my son's friends listen to this, so that's why I ask. You're talking to a young person who's trying to figure things out. What do you think would be the number one thing you would tell them that they need to be successful in whatever they do?
To be a good person.
Yeah.
Just to have a good character about you. My granddad taught me this. He said, outwork everyone in the room when no one is there watching. If you do that, let me tell you, most people work hard when someone's watching them, right? Mm-hmm. But if you're alone in your own environment by yourself in a weight room, doesn't matter what you're doing in life, right? Mm-hmm. studying for the bar.
Yeah.
You got to be the best that you can, your best version of Josh, best version of Jim, best version of your son when no one is watching. And if you do that every single day of your life, you will be successful. But no doubt, because we as human beings have the capability to do whatever we need within the confines. And most of us have confinements that we can't go out and do some of the things we want to do. But if you just tell yourself, listen, I'm just going to work my ass off because nobody else is watching, you'll be just fine.
It really is true that the person you are is the person you are when you're by yourself.
Oh, you better believe it. Yeah. I mean, we all have some demons, you know. I mean, like I said earlier, I'm still trying to wrestle the anger demon in me. My wife and I talk about, and it's just who I am, right? It's just, it's part of who I am. And that's probably why I was so successful going from an offensive tailback and finally getting a coach that saw the ability in me with my aggression and who I was. And I traded my position from tailback to inside linebacker, and I just flourished.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's in us, all of us, to be successful. We just need to parlay that into knowing, hey, work your ass off even when no one's watching. If you keep telling yourself that, there's no excuses, right?
Yeah, I mean,
there's no excuses. Like, you know, and the parents say, hey, you better get your homework done. Well, are you doing the homework for yourself, or are you doing the homework to impress your parents?
Right.
But you know, it is what it is. So
Well, I have three questions I ask everybody, and I think it's a good segue into those three questions to wrap up our interview. And I appreciate your time.
You bet.
The first one is, I mean, you've had a lot of successes. What do you think your biggest success in life is?
Being a parent.
Yeah. Now, why do you say that over everything else?
Well, that's a good question. I think, because it's long-term, it's the love that you feel on a daily basis. When your kids are doing well, you as a parent, that's all you care about is their happiness. And if they're happy, the parent's happy. And if you're happy, I mean, that transcends itself. Oh my gosh. I mean, like I told you right before the podcast started, my mom just passed away 2 weeks ago, and she was the most loving, the happiest person. Any person that I could talk to, our siblings, our family, nobody saw a better, happier person. And if you just do that in life, wow. I mean, it's everything. It really is.
Yeah. I got to tell you, it's the hardest and most rewarding thing I've ever done is having kids.
I mean,
it's scary. It's fun. It makes you laugh. It makes you cry. It makes you stay up at night. You know, it's everything. It's what you think about all day.
Every emotion. I mean, today my kids are 29, 33, and 36. But my wife, that's all we talk every day. We talk about our kids. We're on the phone with them. We're talking to our grandkids. And it's a lifelong process to be a better person to your kids. But it's a lifelong process to creating memories for a lifetime. And they never go away.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that being said, what would you think is your biggest failure in life? And what did you learn from it?
Mm-hmm. I've never been asked that question.
My
biggest failure and what I've learned from it. biggest failure in life. Can I think about that? Failure in life and what I learned from it.
Because I think you learn the most from your failures. You know what I mean?
Sure.
When you fail, you make, you know, I've learned a ton in failure. So. You don't have any.
all of us have failures. I just have never been asked. I've never even thought of that.
it's okay.
Let's come back to that one.
We can come back to that one. Well, this is the question I think that I think about this all the time. And that is, you know, one day your mother just passed away. And like I said, off air, I don't know what that's like. That's got to be really tough because I love my mom to death. We have a you know, my mom is the glue of our family.
Yeah.
Sometimes too much glue. But like, yeah. You know, and so I can't imagine, but you know, I'm sure that makes you kind of reflect on your own life, and you know, one day you're going to have a funeral and there's going to be a eulogy. What would you hope the one thing someone says in your eulogy is?
Yeah. And I've thought about that. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned it just a couple seconds ago, is I want people to remember me as just being a good person, just being that good guy.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't take much just to put a smile on your face and welcome people, right? You find out in business, you know, you get around a bunch of executives, everybody wants to act executive. Hey, just at the end of the day, all of us usually put our pants on the same way. We go to the bathroom, usually say everything. If we can just learn just to pass on goodwill to people and be that good guy, that's really what I care about, is just being, I want people to remember me as just being a good person.
Yeah. 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 You know, you said something really interesting there, and that is that, you know, that I kind of want to extrapolate on. And that is, I don't think we realize truly the effect that we can have on people for the good and the bad. You never know when something you say is going to make or break someone's day.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are people out there who've said things to me that I'm sure they don't, you know, that I still remember, that they probably don't even remember they said.
That's very true.
Yeah, very true. And same for the other way. There have been times, I remember one time this lady in the middle of a very difficult time, I hadn't seen her in years. I went to church with her probably a decade before, and I was having a real struggle. I was at a Sacramento Kings game, and I saw her and her husband, and I just said, "Hey, how you doing?" And she gave me the biggest, most loving hug. And I just remember thinking that was exactly what I needed at that moment. And I don't think even knows how important that was.
That's right. That's right.
So, you know, be kind.
Yeah.
You know?
Just be kind. I've tried to learn through my wife's accomplishments and who she is as a human being is you never know what's going on in someone else's life. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of us take things personally, which I do.
Yeah.
The way people drive, maybe somebody doesn't open the door for you at a restaurant, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the last few years, I've really tried to take myself out of being Jim and looking at people and saying, maybe they didn't open the door because maybe their mom just passed away. Maybe they're going through a rough time. Maybe they lost their job. So a lot of times you have to not take things personally, that it's against us, that maybe something else is going on in that person's life that you have to give pause to, and just consider that we are all human beings, and there's stuff that happens to us everybody has stuff every day. There's stuff. You could look at the most successful human being on the world and think they have it all going on, but at the end of the day, when they go into their house, they have the same issues and problems that the rest of us have. All of us have the same stuff, right?
Yeah.
I think we would all agree with that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And not only that, but well, except for those people who don't re-rack their weights. there's no excuse for that.
You find that with these millennials. And let me tell you something. I've been in more the last 2 years. I don't know why. There's more kids. And they just, you know, they're flexing in front of the mirrors and they're not putting their equipment away. And you're working out, you are literally standing by your piece of equipment, resting in between sets. And they'll come in and just take the equipment. It's like, no, that's not how it works, bro.
No.
Now, if you want to work in, you can ask me.
Yeah.
And you don't take two machines. I was just listen to this story. I know we're running out. I was just in Montana. And I was there all summer taking care of my mom. And 9 o'clock in the morning, who's ready to fight at 9 o'clock in the morning? So this this guy, that he was probably in his young 20s, and he's working out on the low row machine. And I happened to go over and grab the bar off where he was doing triceps, I guess. And he and I'm changing the bar, and he goes, "Hey, bro, I'm using that." I said, "No, you're not. You're working out there." He goes, "I was working there." I says, "That's not how it works. You don't take, if you're working by yourself, you can't go back between two machines. Now, if I get this machine, now you need to ask me."
Yeah.
You cannot believe what he called me. First time in my life. I mean, and he wanted to, he said, "Let's go outside." I said, "Are you kidding me?"
Yeah.
You
wrong
are
guy.
He said, "I don't need to take it. I don't need to take it outside. I'll kick your ass right here." It was, it's those things like that, that you realize these kids have no idea the etiquette in the gym. So anyway, I'm talking about
putting that's funny. You know, it's, oh God, I wish you would have took him outside. It would have been hilarious.
Because I can't get it off my mind.
He like picked the worst guy, the captain of the American Gladiators.
Just, let me tell you, 10 years ago, and here's the thing, two things that popped in my mind. I was on my fourth interview for the job I have now, and they told me that I'd have to do a background check. That came into my mind. The second thing is I got a bad shoulder, and I thought, I can't get in a fight. I can't even lift my shoulder. And then the third thing I thought was my wife was going to get pissed at me. I'm going to tell you right now, none of that would have ever entered my mind 10 years earlier. I would have just gone for it. That's just how it is. I mean, you don't even, now you get older, you start thinking, really? Do I really? I'm slowing down a little bit.
That's funny. I've had a few of those too, where you're like, oh man, do I really want to do this
right now? You want to go to jail tonight?
Well, listen, you know, I appreciate your time. It's been great to meet you and hear your stories. And sorry about your mother, but I just, it was so cool to interview you because American Gladiators was such a big part of my childhood. And I really enjoyed it, enjoyed talking to you and getting your ideas on life. If people want to follow you or get to know, you know, where you are, where can people find you?
Well, there's two social media and platforms that you can find me. They can find me on Instagram, JimStar32 with two R's. They can find me on Facebook on that. And then I know we didn't mention that, but you know, Netflix came out with our five-part documentary series called Muscles and Mayhem. That was the number one ranked show for 3 weeks in a row for a documentary that Netflix had never seen. That aired last June. And so people can find that on Netflix called Muscles and Mayhem. So 5-episode series. So yeah, people want to check that out and then find me on Instagram and Facebook. And then I'm doing an autograph signing in Rockaway, New Jersey, at a wrestling, I don't know what wrestling, event it is, but I'll be there, this coming Saturday to sign autographs.
Awesome. So, well, good. Well, Laser, it's been a pleasure. And for those who are listening, you know, don't forget to subscribe.
Thanks, Josh. Hey, buddy. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
No problem. All right.